NPR's business news starts with more talk of a GM-Chrysler merger. It's a merger for which the companies might like some federal help. The Bush administration is under pressure from several state governors to provide rescue funds for the auto industry. GM and Chrysler are also pushing the government to help fund their merger, and the two automakers have been talking about combining operations so both of them can better survive. Many say that's the best option, though it would bring painful cuts, NPR's Frank Langfitt reports.
Most analysts say the best hope for two of the Detroit Three is to come together, but the cost of doing so will be big. Grant Thornton, the global accounting firm, says Chrysler would have to slash 16 models. And Kimberly Rodriguez, who handled the firm's analysis, she said the company might have to lay off up to 40,000 workers.
The medicine is fairly bitter, but fundamentally it's required.
That's because demand for vehicles has collapsed amid yo-yoing gas prices, the credit crunch, and a dismal economy. Rodriguez spoke to reporters on a conference call. She said the merger's impact would go far beyond the factory floor.
In the dealer area, Chrysler and GM together, about 22,000 franchises. That is likely to be hit substantially.
Patrick Anderson runs Anderson Economic Group, a Michigan-based research firm. He expects more than 1,000 dealers to close because of the merger.
Michigan, by far, will suffer the worst from the decline in sales. But it's going to be felt in every single state and essentially in every mid-sized town in America.
Anderson says the companies need billions in federal money to finance a merger. Closing down plants and paying severance to union workers is expensive. But Anderson says the alternative, perhaps an ugly bankruptcy, would destroy even more jobs.
Well, essentially, almost all of Chrysler would go away, and would go away fast. And it would go away in a very messy fashion.
Although the companies have been in merger talks, they have made no announcement. GM has been pushing for federal money to support a deal, but Washington has yet to weigh in. Frank Langfitt, NPR News, Washington.
Imagine spending a day with people who work in finance on Wall Street. That must be a depressed group. They're suffering huge losses, surrounded by massive layoffs, and scorned by many of their fellow Americans. NPR's Adam Davidson actually did spend a day this week with finance professionals and found that some of them are downright giddy.
This week was the annual conference of SIFMA, a finance industry trade group. It was at the Marriott Marquis Hotel in Times Square. And I told Lynette Hotchkiss, head of the Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board, that I thought everyone would be really down.
You know, I've been at these conferences for about 10 years, and this is the most crowded and the most energetic. And
energetic?
Yes, yeah. Clearly, people are interested in what the speakers have to say about the future of regulation.
Did you hear that? The future of regulation. For Hotchkiss and a lot of other people here, the shock and pain of the past few weeks has given way, at least a little bit, to hope.
It is a wonderful opportunity to look at the entirety of the financial regulatory framework in the United States and maybe start with a blank sheet of paper.
A blank sheet of paper. Hotchkiss says a lot of U.S. regulation was a panicky response to the last big crisis, you know, the Great Depression. So it's outmoded and confusing. It drives people like her crazy. And now maybe they can throw all that old stuff out and get something that makes sense.
It's a good year for Sybase. It's a very good year for Sybase.
That's Lydia DeGuido with, well, Sybase. And I had one question for her. What is Sybase?
Okay, Sybase is a data management company that specializes in managing and mobilizing information to the point of action.
I have no idea what any of that means.
Did you ever put money in a bank?
Yes.
Okay. Did you ever trade stocks?
Mutual funds.
Okay, well,
I think I'm going to take over here. I learned that Sybase software helps banks keep careful track of all the things they buy and sell. DeGuido says they've been selling a lot of their software this year. Why? Because, here's her sales pitch, Sybase gives financial companies the tools that could have predicted the current crisis if they were used properly.
That's not to say we're seers over here, but it's very clear.
Seers, you mean like prophets?
Seers, like S-E-E-R. We're not seers, but
2 years ago, 3 years ago, like you were saying, people didn't care what their data showed. It just, hey, we're making money.
Exactly, exactly. And now that's not necessarily the case.
You need to know your data.
You need to know your data, and you also need to demonstrate certain things to regulators that maybe you didn't have to in the past.
There were a lot of people at this conference who had ideas for making money in the new post-crisis, new regulation economy. One man sells software that monitors every phone call that employees in a bank make. He says proudly that it's just like what the NSA does, eavesdrop to find dangerous activity. He's hoping Congress passes a law mandating that all banks record phone calls. He says several countries in Asia and Europe already do. Joe Sullivan runs International Market Recruiters, a headhunting firm specializing in financial professional temp work.
More regulation coming in next year should also help us to send people out.
More regulation means more accountants, more lawyers.
Potentially, it means more work's going to need to get done in a place where everybody's lean mean already.
So, more temps. Look, a lot of people in finance, maybe most of them, are, of course, really scared and unhappy these days. But it's the American way to see opportunity, even in the worst times. It probably should be kind of reassuring that even this month, even in New York, you can find a conference full of finance people who are already planning how to profit from the crisis. Adam Davidson, NPR News, New York.
And you can learn more about the current state of the economy on our Planet Money podcast and blog, which you can find at npr.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Today, we'll explore an obscure financial product that's been wreaking havoc across the globe, credit default swaps. If bad mortgages got the financial system sick, then credit default swaps helped spread the illness worldwide. Alex Bloomberg of Chicago Public Radio's This American Life reports on where CDSs came from and why investors found them irresistible.
Like many parts of the financial system these days, credit default swaps are so complicated, simple bankers couldn't have created them. They were invented by people like this guy, Greg Berman.
Actually, my formal training is in physics, so I studied experimental physics and nuclear physics before joining finance in 1993.
Now, just to be clear, Greg didn't invent these things, but he works for a company, Risk Metrics Group, which you won't be surprised to learn helps people manage risk, and so he thinks about them a lot, and he's good at explaining what they are. Imagine, he says, you buy a bond from Ford for $100.
You're holding the bond and you are worried about Ford's credit. So you enter into an agreement with another party where you say to the other party, I will pay you some money. I'll pay you 2% a year, 3% a year, 4% a year. And what you need to do is give me protection. If Ford should go bankrupt, then I'm going to give you back this perhaps worthless bond, and you're going to give me my $100 back. In the big context of things, it looks like insurance.
So, insurance? That's what we're talking about here? People with bonds, which are already considered pretty safe, trying to make them safer? Well, it didn't stay that way.
I think Mae West once said it very, very well when she said, I used to be Snow White, but I drifted.
This is Satyajit Das. He goes by Das. He's a risk consultant who was around when credit default swaps first appeared. NPR economics correspondent Adam Davidson and I talked to him and heard stories from his 30 years working with hedge funds and bankers all over the world as a sort of financial hired gun. He saw firsthand how what started as insurance morphed into something else entirely. In the 1990s, he says, he was a fan of credit default swaps.
But by about 2003, 2004, I was starting to get very nervous. Because what I could see was the market had gone from a very legitimate purpose to something which was much more racy and interesting, but also much more dangerous.
So these clearly had stopped being insurance somewhere along the way.
Oh, absolutely. It stopped being insurance.
And it became gambling?
Well, you know, the line between investing and speculation or gambling in financial markets is always a pretty gray one. But yes.
So, how did we get from one of the safest activities on the planet, insurance, to one of the riskiest, gambling? Well, there's one key difference between an insurance policy and a credit default swap. Again, here's Greg Berman.
The way that I first described the credit default swap is that you own the bond and you'd like to transfer that risk to someone else. But what if I want to buy protection, but I don't own the bond?
So why would I buy protection on a bond I don't own? Isn't that like buying fire insurance on a house I don't own?
It is exactly like buying insurance for a house that you don't own. So it's like you took out fire insurance on your home, and now I also took out fire insurance on your home, and 1,000 other people took out fire insurance on your home. When that happens, what you're doing is you're betting on the house.
So did you get that? A CDS allows people to get paid off by insuring something they don't own. Not a house in this case, but a bond. And here's how it works. A credit default swap is what they call an over-the-counter instrument, meaning it's not something that's traded publicly on an exchange, like a stock. It's a private deal between two people. Those two people can be anyone. Well, anyone with more than $5 million. So that means effectively someone at an investment bank or a hedge fund or at a big commercial bank like Citibank or Credit Suisse. They all have credit default swap desks. Now, every day, the people at this desk are getting thousands of emails and calls from people wanting to enter into credit default swap contracts with them. Sometimes the people calling want it for insurance. They have a bond from, say, the ABC company, but they're a little worried about the ABC company's financial health. They call the people at the credit default swap desk and they say, "Will you sell me credit default swap protection? Will you guarantee that if the ABC company goes down, you'll guarantee the full value of the bond?" But sometimes, often, Das says, they don't have the bond. They just have a hunch about the ABC company.
So they want to essentially bet that ABC company will default. So he and I agree that if ABC company defaults, I will pay him a certain amount. And in return, he pays me some fees.
Das says that during his time in the industry, the amount of credit default swaps that were speculative grew to dwarf the amount that were actually used for insurance. The numbers are staggering. There are $5 trillion worth of bonds issued in the world, but the total amount that people have bet on those bonds is over $50 trillion. That means that for every one person using a credit default swap to insure a bond, there are more than 10 people using a credit default swap to bet on it. And there's one more thing.
All of this is unregulated, partly because they wanted it to be unregulated.
This is Andrew Ng, a professor at Columbia University Business School, who studies the credit default swap market. One of the reasons that they wanted it to be unregulated has to do with a word that you hear a lot when you talk to finance people. That word is leverage. Here, I'll show you.
When you operate on leverage.
The market had become extremely driven by its lust for leverage.
Part of the problem with these swap contracts, they actually have extraordinarily high leverage.
You see what I mean? Well, here's what they mean by leverage. Say I have a hedge fund with $100 million, and I want to make a killing in the credit default swap market. I start calling and emailing to all those credit default swap desks and hedge funds out there saying, "I'm selling protection. Who wants to buy?" Someone calls me and says, "I have a $1 billion bond from Lehman Brothers. I want to insure it." I say, "Great. I will insure your bond if you agree to pay me 2% of its value every year." You say, "All right, and we're in business." Now, let's review these numbers. 2% of $1 billion, that's $20 million, which I get every year. My hedge fund, $100 million. So I've signed one piece of paper, and in 5 years, I've doubled my money. I'm psyched, my investors are psyched. That is the upside of leverage. I'm making profits on $1 billion, even though I only have $100 million. The downside of leverage is that now I'm on the hook for up to $1 billion if the bond defaults. And I don't have $1 billion. In 2005, this particular bet on a Lehman Brothers bond seemed like a sure thing. The idea that Lehman Brothers, one of the oldest and largest investment banks in the world, could possibly default seemed crazy. In 2008, it became scarily, unbelievably real.
Tomorrow, reporter Alex Bloomberg explains the role credit default swaps played in destabilizing the global financial system. Now, to a county that's been hit hard by financial troubles, Jefferson County, Alabama. The county seat is Birmingham. By tomorrow, the county has to pay millions of dollars in interest on bonds, and it doesn't have the money. And that means it may be close to filing what would be the biggest municipal bankruptcy in U.S. history. From member station WBHM, Tanya Ott reports.
County commission meetings are usually pretty mundane.
A resolution to adjust the salaries of district.
But at a recent Jefferson County Commission meeting in Birmingham, a routine reading of county business revealed a lot of underlying tension and passive aggression.
Go off on a different subject to get us away from this, you know, by talking about other procedures.
I'm glad you're in my brain cells this morning. I didn't realize I was doing that.
I went clear on this. We don't pay.
Emotions are high as the county faces not one, but two bond payment deadlines tomorrow, payments officials can't afford to make. It's complicated, but here's what happened. Several years ago, the county renegotiated debt for sewer upgrades, swapping fixed-rate bonds for adjustable ones. Those rates have gone up dramatically, and the county is now $3.2 billion in debt for the sewer. That triggered the companies holding the county's non-sewer debt to also call for payment. So tomorrow, the county is supposed to pay $90 million. County officials have been working furiously to strike a deal, but at a recent meeting, Commission President Betty Fine Collins kept it close to the vest.
I really don't want to get into that for this reason. Remember the word negotiation. If you reveal what the negotiations will be, it might muddy the water.
It's already muddy. Several commissioners have competing plans for solving the mess. Various state leaders have weighed in with other ideas, and critics say the power plays are getting in the way. The back and forth frustrates everyone, including Alabama Governor Bob Riley.
When we start having negative reports in national and international magazines about our choice not to pay debt, then we better take it seriously.
Riley sat on the sidelines initially, but has stepped up to negotiate $1 billion in concessions from Wall Street creditors. This week, he renewed his call for Washington to commit some of the federal bailout money to Jefferson County. Some observers have suggested bankruptcy might be the best option, but Riley disagrees.
Morally, I have a real problem with somebody walking in and saying, I'm not going to pay that bill, I'm going to let somebody else worry about it. We have an obligation to all of the people in this state to make sure that everyone lives up to their duty to say what they mean, and when they do, mean what they say.
Pinched by sewer prices that have more than tripled in just a few years, local business leaders are worried. Russell Cunningham, president of the Birmingham Regional Chamber of Commerce, says if the county defaults, the resulting cuts to basic services would be a huge drag.
Because the curtailment could be in the educational system. It most definitely will be in public safety and public service, and all economic development activities would be at risk.
The county's reputation is already at risk. Since 2005, four former county commissioners have been prosecuted for public corruption while in office. The latest pleaded guilty this week to accepting thousands of dollars in gifts from an investment banker handling the sewer bond deal. Birmingham's mayor, a former county commissioner, is also under investigation, and more criminal charges are expected. For NPR News, I'm Tanya Ott in Birmingham.